Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of all ages, cats and dogs, iguanas, reptiles, and all sentient creatures capable of listening to what I have to say. This is John St. Germain, the voice of the Crystal Silence League, greeting you once again. It is Tuesday, December 15th, 2015. And, man, are we glad to be here. I'm always glad to be here. One time I did this show with an ugly intestinal flu, and I was still glad to be here. That's probably more than you want to know. Should I contract leprosy, the bubonic plague, and the Green Death, I will still be glad to do this show. God forbid. Tonight we're discussing the Wings of Enlightenment, the Seven Factors of Enlightenment, and we're going to go back and forth between that and other things as we dwell deeply into this Dhamma discussion. But first, let's talk about our Crystal of the Week, Orange Kyanite. Orange Kyanite, like all kyanites, work on very high vibrations, and it Orange Kyanite, of course, is associated with the sacral chakras. Orange Kyanite is very good for creative expression. It's good for dealing with addiction. It's good for dealing with self-expression. It's good for dealing with expression of all sorts. Specifically, I'll tell you what it's very good for. If you're creative and you have trouble expressing it, connecting it with between the lyrical and the expressive mode, it's very good for bridging that. For instance, say you like to sit at home and play the guitar, and you're very good at playing the guitar, but it's hard when you're in front of other people, you freeze up. It's very good for that. It can give you the confidence to express your creativity in front of other people. It's good for negotiations. It's good when you're trying to communicate ideas to other people, and it gives you the confidence to connect with other people. If you're slightly or even tremendously aloof, if you tend to have trouble connecting and forming empathetic bridges with other people, Orange Kyanite is very good for that. We are the Crystal Silence League, and for those of you who don't know, the Crystal Silence League was formed around 1917 to 1919 by Mr. Claude Conlon with the express purpose of spreading and projecting positive affirmation and prayer to those who need it. And when Mr. Conlon passed into the silence around 1958 or so, the Crystal Silence League passed with him. It was founded again around 2009, I think, by adepts of the Missionary Independent Spiritual Church, or was it around 2012? Around there. In cybernetic form, and you can find us at www.crystalsilenceleague.org, where many people, many hundreds of people, post prayers. And on the prayers, prayer is always free, no charge. We don't charge for prayers at the Crystal Silence League. And when you do that, people read those prayers and pray for you, and to acknowledge that they prayed for you, people will go click. And you'll get an email that says, yes, you were prayed for. And hundreds of people go there and do that. So it's my custom that we read these prayers aloud. And we don't identify them by name. We read just a few of them aloud, not hundreds of them. We would never quit. And pastors of the Crystal Silence League print these out and place them on our altars every day. And we also project through crystal ball projection positive affirmations three times a day. You can join the Crystal Silence League. You can become a member, and you can buy crystals from us, and also a couple of books that were written by our founder, Mr. Claude Conlon. And these books are Crystal Gazing and Personal Lessons, Codes, and Instructions for members of the Crystal Silence League. There's also some books and compilations of crystal ball works underway by members and pastors of the Crystal Silence League. That very exciting news there. So let's start. We have prayer ID number 45119, who prays the removal of negative energies and curses on her and her family. May that happen. And she prays that the curses be mirrored and sent back to the haters who put those curses and negative energies on her. We also have prayer ID number 45118, who prays for self-esteem and prays for her friend Z, who has the personal strength to find inner peace and true self-love. prayer ID number 45117, JB, who prays for a loved one who's going to court and prays that the judge has mercy on his situation. Prayer ID number 45116, RT, who's being cursed by a cabal of witches and prays that they have their curses turned back upon them. Prayer ID number 45115, who prays for the spirits to help resolve his issues with W. Prayer ID number 45132 prays because apparently her mother's being hassled over credit card debt that she did not run identity theft, I suppose. Prayer ID number 45131, who prays for her and someone whose initial is T to start a friendship. Apparently that friendship is desired to grow into more than a friendship, into a relationship. Prayer ID number 45130 prays for reconciliation and reconciliation and romance with someone whose initial is D. Prayer ID number 45129 prays for her autistic son to communicate with her better. Prayer ID number 45127 is anonymous, and this person prays for protection, healing, and continued contact with someone whose initials are JM. And we have prayer ID number 45114, who prays for a loved one who is long-term homeless in bad health and no resources for 5 or more years in Plainfield, New Jersey. Prayer ID number 45113, MT, prays for a person whose initial is N to keep his job. And we have an anonymous prayer, 45126, who prays to the Creator for blessings, good luck, and good fortune for everyone who has prayed for this person. It's a prayer of gratitude. Prayer ID number 45125, who prays for someone named N, and themselves, this is an anonymous prayer, for a steady, loving, passionate, and happy relationship. And prayer ID number 45124, who prays that all of CB's evil be turned back upon him. Prayer ID number 45123, MS, prays a prayer of thanks to the Lord for all that the Lord has provided for this person so far, and knows that the Lord's work it and finish, and prays for patience. Man, I could use some of that right now. Prayer ID number 45121 prays prays for financial help to pay for the medicine that will help his medical condition. And prayer ID, finally, 45120, prays for help in his legal matters, his court case. Let's take a moment of silence for those who need help in these situations, and for all those who need comfort, help, and solace. Amen. Someone has mentioned that there's hope for that there's help for autistic children at www.gemini, G getstartedgenii.org, /#getstarted, getstarted. A good, very good little thing. Some of our good people in house said that when they read over a prayer list, it brings tears to their eyes. Occasionally, the first time I read over a prayer list, I couldn't stand it. It moved me deeply. It took me a long time before I could read over our prayer list. It's heartbreaking when you first read over the prayer list of the Crystal Silence League. It takes practice. It really does to be inundated by hundreds of prayers for help and solace and comfort. The suffering of the world is intense, and if you ever doubted the truth of the first noble truth that there is suffering, just come over to our prayer site and read for 10 minutes. There is indeed great suffering in the world. There is indeed great suffering. The wings of enlightenment. To the inquiring Kalamas, the Buddha said, right it is to doubt, right it is to question what is doubtful and what is not clear. In a doubtful matter, wavering does arise. And the Buddha once had a dialogue with his disciples. The Buddha said, if not knowing this and perceiving this, would you say, we honor our master and through respect for him, we respect what he teaches? No, Lord. That which you affirm, O disciples, is it not only that which you yourselves have recognized, seen, and grasped? Yes, Lord. So, in conformity with this thoroughly correct attitude of true inquiry, the philosophers of later times observed, as the wise test the purity of gold by burning, cutting, and examining it by means of a piece of touchstone. That's where the word touchstone comes from. Did you know that? You tested gold with it. You rubbed it against the touchstone. So should you accept my words after examining them and not merely out of regard and reverence for me. Thus blind belief is condemned in the analytical teachings of the Buddha. There is no blind belief. It's condemned, in fact. The truth of the Dharma can be grasped only through calm, concentrative thought and insight, which is called, and these are words you'll come across quite a bit, samatha and vipassana, and never through blind faith. So if you go in quest of the truth, you're never satisfied with surface knowledge. You want to delve deep. This is the sort of search encouraged in Buddhism, and this is what we're talking about with the second wing of enlightenment. Keen investigation of the Dharma, looking below the surface of things. A sharp analytical knowledge of understanding the true nature of all things. You don't just take the surface explanation. You look below it. You go down deep. So whoever reflects on the rise and fall of the aggregates, you're going to experience a very strange thing. We talked about the aggregates. We talked about those, the five aggregates, the five skandhas. Whoever dwells on those, you're going to experience a strange thing, a sense of release, joy and happiness. And that's very funny when you think, you know, things are unreliable and impermanent and subject to decay and passing away. You think, man, that's depressing. But no, you don't. You experience a sense of wonderment. And, you know, you understand that what's impermanent and not lasting, you see it as fraught with sorrow. What's impermanent and sorrow fraught, you understand as void of a permanent and everlasting self or ego or soul or entity. And grasping to that is what causes unhappiness. Not realizing that, but grasping to it. That's what's the source of the unhappiness, the clinging to it. And you realizing it, you realize the three characteristics that we discussed, the laws of transience, sorrow, and not self. Impermanence, sorrow, and not self, which in Pali, and these are words that you'll run across a lot, anicca, dukkha, anatta. Anicca, which is impermanence, dukkha, which is suffering, and anatta, which is not self. That's known to Buddhists as penetrative insight. Understanding anicca, dukkha, and anatta. That's known as penetrative insight. It's understanding of those three things. And like the edge of a razor, understanding that, like the edge of a razor, it just cuts through all the bullshit of the world. It just cuts through it. And insight hits you like a great joy. And I remember mowing the yard. I tell the story a lot. I was mowing the yard one day. I had a 2-acre yard, and I used to mow it in 3 days. I took 3 days to mow it, and it was kind of like a meditation for me. And I didn't use a riding lawn mower. No, sir. I used a push mower. It was a gas mower, but it was a push mower. And I went up and down these hills. And occasionally, these turtles would walk across my yard in droves. And I'd stop and take the turtles. I'd pick them up. I picked them up by the dozens. I had dozens of turtles carrying them across my yard. I'd stop and carry them. And it would be a terrible thing for me to run over a turtle. And it never happened to me. It happened to my son. My son ran over a turtle. And, oh, man, it traumatized him. But it would be a terrible thing for me to run over a turtle, and I'd carry those turtles, and I'd mow that yard. And then one day, I remember when it came upon me, the truth of dukkha, the truth that everything was impermanent, subject to decay, and filled with suffering. And I was so happy. I was so happy. There was this great sense of happiness that it was like a fist inside of me. It's like I had a fist inside of me and the fist relaxed. That's exactly what it felt like. And at that moment, I gave up trying to become anything. That's the only way I can put it. I gave up trying to become anything. Didn't mean I became a bum. Didn't mean I became worthless. But I quit striving. I quit trying to become anything. It was like that horizon out there that I kept. I kept seeing something imaginary on that horizon. That horizon disappeared. I was now. I was here and now. And I was so happy. I'm not telling you that I became enlightened by any means, but I realized the truth. I'd been investigating the Dharma for years and years, and reading this stuff and saturating my mind with it. And then just in that mowing the yard, where my mind was elsewhere, my mind wasn't dwelling on it, but my mind was filled with it. I wasn't obsessed with it and trying to analyze it. I wasn't even trying to think about it. Just where my mind was absorbed utterly with concentration. Don't run over a turtle. Don't run over a turtle. Don't run over a turtle. For God's sake, don't run over a turtle. When my mind was not thinking about it, I realized it. You see, I was looking somewhere else and realized it. And that's kind of like what happens in meditation, I guess. But I was so focused on not hitting these turtles that the back of my mind, where I'd programmed it, went boom and wow. Wow, I got it, got it, got it, got it, got it, got it, got it. And it was so good, such a good moment. And, you know, I never backslid. You know, once you get it, you get it. It's kind of like riding a bike. Once you ride a bike, you're always going to be able to ride a bike. So this is very important. And, you know, it's as simple as that. Now, the third enlightenment factor is energy. But before we do that, I want to go in a side topic a little while. And we talked last week about good company, about how spiritual company is important, and I want to talk about that. Where the Buddha talked to Ananda, and Ananda said, "Lord, the spiritual friendship, spiritual companionship, and intimacy is no less than half the spiritual life." And the Buddha said, "Oh, don't say that, Ananda. It's the whole life, not half the spiritual life." And so what we understand with this is that by having friends that are of high spiritual quality and nobility, it programs us to be the same. And I'd like to call your attention to studies. I wrote about them in the newsletter this month, if you'd like to download it. There are studies that have shown us that the more we think about something, the more we etch this into our brain, the synapses of a specific thought fire more readily the more you think about something. Let's say you think a happy thought. The synapses associated with happiness fire more. And brain mapping has shown that the more two synapses, and what synapses are, I'll explain that. Neurons or brain cells have these tips called synapses. These are the ends of two neurons, and there's a gap between them. The gap is the space between two synapses. When you think a thought, there's an electric spark that jumps across it, like a spark plug gap. And so when you think a thought, there's a spark goes across the two brain cells, and the tips of those brain cells are called a synapse. So when the more often you think a thought, those sparks are going zit, 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 And brain mapping has shown that the more those two neurons fire, the more those synapses fire, the two synapses will start to grow closer together to increase the efficiency of that gap, of that spark. So the more you think, you know, this is why when you're learning a skill, you know, say you're learning to play a piano, the more you practice, the better you get at it. You're etching it into your brain. You're hardwiring your brain. The more you read something over and over and over and over again, you're etching it into your brain. The more you think a specific thought, the more you're etching it into your brain. So the more you think depressing thoughts, the more you're etching it into your brain. The physical structure of your brain changes. So we say in New Thought that when you think a certain way, you change reality. This is physical evidence that you do change the physical structure of your brain. So in Buddhism, it's said that when you start thinking unwholesome thoughts, to redirect them, to say stop, and direct them toward wholesome ways, what you're doing is rewiring your brain. You're literally rewiring your brain. You're telling it no and going in a new direction and causing new synaptic circuits to form. This is very important. So other studies have shown that not only you, but the people you hang around can cause this program. If you're with a group of people who share beliefs and they speak them and continually repeat them, this too can create synaptic growth. You know, say you're around a bunch of people who, it's what explains mob mentality. A bunch of people are going, yeah, let's go do this, let's go do that. And you're going, well, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. The more you hear it, the more it causes synaptic growth in that direction. This is hardwiring. This is why children raised in families that have ignorant beliefs are more likely to share them. They hear it, it hardwires them, and it's really hard to undo hardwiring that occurs at an early age. It's really hard. You can do it, but you got to really, really work to make those cognitive shifts. So it's important to have good company. It's important to be with people of good and noble intentions. This helps encourage your own brain hardwiring. This is the physical part. Nothing to do with spirituality whatsoever. This is nothing magical. This is the spiritual part. So keeping good company and good companionship and surrounding yourself with good thinking is really important until you reach a point to where you can put yourself around a very, very strong negativity and overcome it with your own cognitive strength. And that takes practice. This sort of thing takes practice. Once you've etched your circuits in so well that nobody can overcome them, that's a very, very good skill to have. So there's a very good story. Anuruddha, Nandaya, and Kambila, who were three monks, are staying together in a quiet grove. And the Buddha goes to visit them one evening, and he asks whether they get on well with one another. Anuruddha confirms that he and the other two are living in concord with mutual appreciation without disputing. They blend like milk and water, says Anuruddha, viewing each other with kindly eyes. Now the Buddha, who knew that not all his monks got along so easily, you know, he was always putting out fires, inquires how they do this. Anuruddha explained that he considers himself fortunate to be living the spiritual life together with such companions as Nandaya and Kambila. He says to do so is a great gain. Now that's important, a great gain. Now the way these three men live together is an expression of metta. Metta is a word that means loving kindness or friendliness. So he maintains, by considering this a great gain, a kindly attitude that manifests in kindly deeds, affectionate speech, loving thoughts. So this sutta, which is very long, concludes by, he tells the Buddha, we're different in body, Venerable Sir, but not in mind. We're one in mind. And so the Buddha expresses great pleasure at these words, and he asks whether they're living diligent, ardent, and resolute. In other words, are they striving for spiritual progress, or are they just kind of laying around doing the whatever they did 3,000 years ago that was the analog of playing video games, you know, and playing video games and watching cartoons? And Anuruddha confirms that they are, and he describes their way of life, which seems to be the natural expression of the spirit of harmony and mutual service that they already mentioned. And the way he describes this, it imparts a sense of how their spiritual practice flows from the friendship. It's a natural growth of their friendship, just as much as their friendship flows from their spiritual practice. And I'll read this to you. Some of it's pretty long, but I want to read this to you. Whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food prepares the seeds, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts the refuse bucket in its place. Whichever of us returns last eats any food left over, if he wishes. Otherwise, he throws it away where there is no greenery or drops it into water where there is no life. He puts away the seeds and the water for drinking and for washing. He puts away the refuse bucket after washing, and he sweeps out the refectory. Whoever notices that the pots of water for drinking, washing, or the latrine are low or empty takes care of them. If they're too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of the hand, and they move it by joining hands. But because of this, we do not break out into speech. But every 5 days, we sit together all night discussing the Dharma. That's how we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. In other words, they just silently serve and help each other. They attend to whatever needs to be done for the sake of the others, without pausing to calculate whether the distribution of labor is fair, whether life is fair. They don't check up on whether the others are doing their share. They live in constant kindly attentiveness to each other's needs, and their kindness goes beyond just reciprocating. What a wonderful way to live. What a wonderful way to live. And why don't people want to live this way? Why doesn't everyone want to live this way instead of everybody trying to grab what's theirs? Oh, you didn't do your share. You didn't do your share. Oh, my God, life's so unfair. Life's so unfair. Oh, my God, it's not fair. I want more. Why doesn't everybody live this way? Driving today, just today, at an intersection, two women in vans, they stopped in the middle of the intersection. I guess one of them interfered with the other's turn. They stopped in the middle of the intersection, rolled their windows down, and, man, they weren't wishing each other Merry Christmas, I'll tell you that. And with gesture, speech, and thought, there was more hostility exhibited than you can imagine. Just because of why, I have no idea. And then they went on their way, both of them, angrily gesturing at each other. The mind state was the furthest thing from metta you can imagine. Driving further on, turning a corner, somebody was angrily blaring their horn at somebody else. And again, it wasn't Happy New Year. And then in the drive-thru window at Starbucks, apparently there was a mistake in the order, and the guy behind me laid on his horn. And you know what? By God, you don't do that at Starbucks. You just don't do that at Starbucks. So let's take a moment for station identification. My Tomcat is going crazy trying to get out of my studio here, and I got to open the door for him and let him out. And you know what? No matter what is going on in the world, no matter what happens in the world, you got to do what the cat says. So, you know, he's about to tear my desk up, so let's let the cat out and let's have some station identification.
You are listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, Kai Armand broadcasts On Sacred Ground, a tapestry of our times comprising history, ethnography, and shamanism, featuring the voices of the land and the deceased, aided by scholars, spirit workers, and environmentalists. Kai's show airs from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. And on Saturday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Saturday nights from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shape signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
And I'm back, and my Tomcat is out. Man, I can't tell you the destruction he was wreaking in my small office and desk, and how if you saw the one pointed focus I had on my notes and on, I mean, you had no idea, did you, from the calmness of my voice, that there was a 20-pound Tomcat on my desk and sinking his claws into my leg, trying to get out of bed. I just calmly continued until it was time for the break. You would admire, you would think I was a Buddha. Last week we were talking about what do you call a Buddhist? The word Buddhist came about the 19th century when it was they were trying to figure out what to call us. Well, Buddhists were known as Upasaka or Upasika if you were female, and Upasaka was considered the word means attendant, and that's the title really for followers of Buddhism. If you want to be picky about it, followers of Gautama. Prince Gautama, who are not monks, nuns, or novices. If you were a monk, you were a bhikkhu. If you were a nun, you were a bikini. Not bikini, but bukini. And but the Upasaka, or the Upasika, was someone who took certain vows. Traditionally, to be an Upasaka, you stated orally, you repeated the three refuges, the triple gem, which means that you take refuge in the Buddha, the Sangha, and the Dharma, and you undertake the five precepts. And this is one of the things one of the tangents I wanted to go into today is the five precepts. If you follow the five precepts, now traditionally an Upasaka now follows the eight precepts. You're sort of like a lay monk, sort of, but the five precepts are undertaken by most serious Buddhists. And these are, I undertake the precept to not take the life of a sentient being unnecessarily. I undertake the precept to not take what has not been given to me. I will refrain from sexual misconduct. I will refrain from false speech, false or divisive speech, usually. I will refrain from intoxicants that will make me heedless. I want to talk about these out of order. Of course, taking life needlessly is murder. It's murder. And usually it's taking life with malicious intent. You know, a lot of Buddhists worry, oh my God, I stepped on a bug, the karma. But, you know, if you step on a bug and you did it by accident, there's no foul. You didn't mean to do it. If you see a bug, oh my God, a bug, I hate bugs, and you're stomping it to death, there's aversion in your mind. There's aversion in your mind. So there is a negative karma, and there will be negative vipaka from that karma. You killed a bug maliciously. You took a sentient life out of hatred. And yes, there is karma. That was a volitional act. The mental formations, the citta-sikkhas, were aversion, hatred, and fear. And attendant to that, mental formations arose that generated vipaka that will bear fruit later. That's the analysis of that. But if you're just walking down the street and you look, you know, you're talking to a friend and you hear crunch and you stepped on a beetle, you say, you know, oh poor beetle. As you say, oh man, I'm sorry, you know, I'm sorry, brother. You know, better luck next time. You know, sorry about that, and let it go. You know, I don't stay awake all night thinking, oh my God, you know, that bug's gonna that bug in the next life, that bug's gonna eat me or something. I don't, you know, you let it go. So it's common sense with that. You know, it's common sense. Because sometimes you do intentionally kill. If you're starving to death, you intentionally kill something to eat. You do intentionally kill. I see hunting for sport as murder. If you kill something because you enjoy it, there's something wrong with you. There's just something wrong with you. If you're killing an animal and you're eating it, that's a little more acceptable if you're eating it. But none of us have to kill for food in this society. We don't have to. And guys are saying, well, I'm thinning the herd. They'd starve to death anyway. So you're really telling me you're going out there and tracking deer and shooting them in the head because you're doing this out of compassion for the animal. You know, look me in the eye and say that with a straight face, that you're doing this because you love the animal and it's a mercy killing. Look me in the eye and seriously say that. You know, like Walter Palmer, the guy that killed Cecil the Lion, he did that because he loved that animal, okay? If you're going out there and killing something because you enjoy killing it, there's something wrong with you. You know, there's something wrong with you. And that's just, you know, prove me wrong. So that's pretty obvious. Now, the premise, the precept against false speech is not just lying. It's divisive speech. And it's harmful speech. So there's gossip. There's speech that's intended to be misleading and manipulative. Let me tell you some things that get difficult here. Some things that get difficult. What do you do when your wife or your woman says, honey, do these jeans make my ass look smaller? What do you do? I mean, is a lie, is a merciful lie or a lie, a white lie, false speech? Yes. Yes, it is. It's false speech. A lie to get out of a difficult situation is unskillful speech. It is. And so I'll tell you how I got out of that very situation, not with my current wife, but with my second. I've been married four times, my second wife. And people say, John, you've been married four times? Yeah, that's a long story. I'll go into it one day. They're all wonderful women. All wonderful women. It's just to live with someone like me takes a very special kind of woman who I finally found. But she said, she'd been working out, and honey, is my butt smaller? And here's how I dealt with it. I said, honey, you know I love your behind. You know, I love your behind. That's how I dealt with it. I told the truth. I substituted a truth rather than say, no, your ass is as big as it's ever been. So, you see, this is what you have to do. I substituted. Now, some people might say that was disingenuous, and maybe it was. But rather than tell a harmful truth, I substituted a good truth, a useful truth. I didn't, you know, I could have told a harmful truth and been true to reality. You know, been true to the precept of telling the truth. But instead, I chose to tell a compassionate truth. I substituted a compassionate truth, which I think was a good thing. It was a good decision. I said, no, honey, you know I love your ass. I didn't say no. I said, honey, you know I love your ass. Your ass looks great. And I was telling the truth. I did. I like a big booty on a woman. I do. I like a big booty on a woman. I'm telling the truth. Now, if you're some guy that likes a Twiggy and, you know, your wife's booty is getting big and you're thinking, oh man, I wish you'd lose some weight, then you know you got another problem on your hands. And here's another one. Let's turn it around. A guy asks his wife or his woman, am I the best lover you ever had? Well now, oh man, you know, what does the woman do? Well first of all, a man should never ask that question, because if you're so insecure that you have to ask that question, the answer is probably no, you're not. So don't ever ask that question. Because you're gonna, you know, if she's gonna lie to you, and you're gonna know it's a lie, she's gonna go, yeah, baby, yeah, you rock my world, yeah, and you're gonna say, she's lying to me, or she's gonna tell you the truth and go, well, no, actually, you know, Rocky, you know, he was a lot better than you. So, But, you know, there's room for improvement. You know, I can, you know, keep practicing. So, you know, guys, don't ever ask that question. You know, like I say, if you're so insecure you have to ask, then the answer is probably no, sucker, you're not the best lover she ever had. So these are examples of things. False speech can be gossip. It's idle speech. It's sitting around and talking a bunch of crap that's not useful. It's idle speech. It's a very nuanced precept, and these precepts are not commandments. Thou shalt not do this. Precepts are nuanced. They're situational, and they're meant to have you think about your actions. There's sometimes really no right and wrong with these. Sexual misconduct, rape, having sex that's inappropriate, underage, someone who's involved with someone else, someone who you're not supposed to have sex with because of custom, using manipulation, coercion, threats, violence, lying to them to get it, manipulating them to get it, misrepresenting yourself to get it. It's pretty much common sense. I mean, you pretty much know what sexual misconduct is. It's pretty much common sense. You just don't do it. I will not take what hasn't been given to me. That's not just stealing. That's assuming. Sometimes we assume, well, you know, they won't mind if I take that. Cheating on your taxes. Here's something. My wife and I and mother-in-law went shopping, and we noticed that like a little chapstick had fallen in the cart, and we didn't pay for it. My mother-in-law said, well, you know, what they don't know won't hurt them. And my wife and I looked at each other, and I went in and paid for it. It was not acceptable to my wife or I to not pay for that. I went in, I mean, it was 89 cents, but it was inconceivable to me. And this is how this stuff sinks into me. I could not leave without paying for that because it was not given to me. You see, I had to go in and pay for that chapstick. And, you know, my mother-in-law was just like, what the hell? You know, I think she considers things like that an act of God. If a store gives me too much change, I give it back. It was not given to me. I don't consider that an act of God or karma or any other rationalization. It's not right. It's not mine. So you don't take what's given to you. refrain from becoming intoxicated. This, again, is common sense. Is it okay to have a beer? You know, I can't tell you if it's okay or not. That's something you have to decide. For me, it's best to not take a chance with it. I'll tell you that I drink so little, I might as well not drink. I might as well don't. When I have a really good dinner, I like to have wine with it. They pour me a glass of wine, and I drink maybe a third of it. You know, I mean, I've not been a guzzler of beer or a sipper of whiskey ever. And now and again, I like a cognac, I'll tell you that. But when I drink a cognac, I put about half an inch or less than an inch in a brandy snifter, and I smell it for 20 minutes and then take 20 minutes to drink it. I probably absorb more alcohol when I gargle. But I never drink enough, anywhere near enough, to where it affects my blood alcohol. I can't tell you. I couldn't tell you. Well, probably the last time I was drunk, I was 17. So, and I'm 55. So, becoming intoxicated makes you heedless and more likely to break the other precepts. You know, this is the thinking behind there. You know, smoking marijuana. I can't tell you. I don't know. I haven't smoked marijuana since I was 17. So I don't know if it makes you heedless. You know, this is something you have to think about yourself. You got to think these things yourself. Caffeine and sugar, some people consider intoxicants. You know, you eat a lot of sugar. If you drink a lot of coffee, it might make you careless in your speech and actions. These are things you have to gauge your own reactions. Morality in Buddhism is called sila, ethics. It's called sila. And so you become an upasaka, you become a follower of the Dharma by taking refuge in the three gems and by taking these five vows. Now, there are additional vows. You don't eat after... the first additional vow is celibacy. And the second additional vow is you don't take any meals after noon. And the third one is you avoid cosmetics, and that includes deodorant. And then there's one about not sleeping on a high bed. You sleep on the floor. And then there's a few others. Now, I was an Upasaka for about 6 years. That means I took the additional vows. I was celibate. I didn't eat after noon. Now, I took an exception to that because I have type 2 diabetes, so I took an extra meal that consisted of a sandwich in midday. And but I was celibate. It's not that hard. And I didn't use cosmetics, including deodorant. But, you know, I shaved my armpits, so it wasn't that bad. And I bathed frequently, and I slept on a mat on the floor. And if you're an Upasaka in the Buddhist community, a lay, you take the lay vows. There's you know, a lot of people, they respect you, and you know, they go, oh, that's great. And you go, okay, well, whatever. It's not that hard, and it's a cool it's a very cool way to live, simple way to live. It's a very simple way to live. I was a vegetarian during that time too, just because, you know, if you're gonna do it, do the way. So that's the life of a Upasaka. Now, when you're taking these vows, it's not a bad way. Now, we can go into this. I'll tell you. Here's some elaboration about how much time do I have? Oh, we got time. I'll tell you about this. Here's Buddha talking about the training rules. There's a case where a certain person, abandoning the taking of life, abstains from the taking of life. He dwells with his rod laid down, his knife laid down, scrupulous, merciful, compassionate, for the welfare of all living beings. Abandoning the taking of what is not given, he abstains from taking what is not given. He does not take, in the manner of a thief, things in a village or a wilderness that belongs to others and have not been given by them. Abandoning sensual misconduct, he abstains from sensual misconduct. He does not get sexually involved with those who are protected by their mothers, their fathers, their brothers, their sisters, their relatives, or their dharma, those with husbands, those who entail punishments, or even those crowned with flowers by another man. There is the case where a certain person, abandoning false speech, abstains from false speech. When he has been called to a town meeting, a group meeting, a gathering of his relatives, his guild, or of royalty, he is asked as a witness, "Come and tell, good man, what you know." If he doesn't know, he says, "I don't know." If he does know, he says, "I know." If he hasn't seen, he says, "I haven't seen." If he has seen, he says, "I have seen." Thus, he doesn't consciously tell a lie for his own sake, for the sake of another, or for the sake of any reward. Abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. And how is one made impure in three ways by bodily action? There's the case where a certain person takes life, is a hunter, bloody-handed, devoted to killing and slaying, showing no mercy to living beings. He takes what is not given. He takes, in the manner of a thief, things in a village or a wilderness that belong to others and have not been given by them. He engages in sensual misconduct. He gets sexually involved with those who are protected by their mothers, their fathers, their brothers, their sisters, their relatives, or their dharma. Those with husbands, those who entail punishments, or even those crowned with flowers by another man. This is how one is made impure by three ways, by bodily action. According to the Buddha, killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, and lying are never skillful. So, in the Pali Canon, the Buddha describes the five precepts not as things you do for yourself. Now listen, these are things you do for other people. These are things you do for your friends. And your friends are everybody. Now there are these five gifts, says the Buddha, five great gifts, original, long-standing, traditional, ancient, unadulterated from the beginning. Don't you love the way he talks? That are not open to suspicion, will never be open to suspicion, and are unfaulted by knowledgeable contemplatives and priests. Which five? There is the case where a disciple of the noble ones, abandoning the taking of life, abstains from taking life. In doing so, he gives freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, freedom from oppression to limitless numbers of beings. In giving freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, freedom from oppression to limitless numbers of beings, he gains a share in limitless freedoms from danger, freedom from animosity, and freedom from oppression. This is the first gift, the first great gift, original, long-standing, traditional, ancient, unadulterated from the beginning, that is not open to suspicion will never be open to suspicion and is unfaulted by knowledgeable contemplatives and priests. And then later on, he talks about the consequences of breaking the precepts. And we'll go into these, at some point. But there are 8 precepts, which are taking life, don't steal, don't have sex, abstain from wrong speech, abstain from intoxicating, don't eat at the wrong time, which is after sunrise and before noon. I undertake to abstain from singing, dancing, playing music, attending entertainment, wearing perfume, and using cosmetics. And I undertake to abstain from luxurious places for sitting or sleeping and overindulging in sleep. So that's the 8 precepts for those of you who want to really go for it. Then there are 10 precepts which the monks take, the novice monks, which are, you don't accept money, and you don't sit on high chair, killing, stealing, chastity, wrong speech, intoxicants, taking food at an inappropriate time, singing, dancing, wearing perfume, sitting on high chairs, and accepting money. So I know when you're a monk, there's over 300 precepts. There's a long list of them. So these are some of the things that you involve that involve you a precept. As we talk about the whole idea of spiritual company, we think about people who are, we seek out the company of people who are advanced in virtue, and I'll tell you that over my life. We talk about part of the life. We're talking about the middle path. We have a question: why is part of that celibacy if it's the middle path? That's a good question. The middle path is not finding the two extremes and then dwelling in the middle. The middle path, as it's been explained to me, is rising above all extremes and dwelling in a state of non-extreme. Celibacy is not an extreme. Celibacy is a state that avoids extremes. It's not celibacy is a natural outgrowth of detachment. It would be an extreme if it were a painful or difficult thing to do. What's extreme is this. There have been cases of people who castrated themselves to practice celibacy. That would be extreme. Celibacy is practiced as a training precept to concentrate on one and one thing only, and that is to separate the mind from the fetter of attachment to sexual desire. You cannot detach yourself from sexual desire while you're engaging in sexual desire. So what happens in sanghas is that sexual tension that's built up is released through nocturnal emissions. The body naturally does it through nocturnal emissions, so monks don't masturbate, for instance. Through the body's natural release, monks who need sexual release, it tends to occur through nocturnal emissions. Now we're getting into the nitty-gritty of the monk life. I'll tell you that the Catholic Church built their monasteries on Buddhist universities. They observed Buddhist universities. We'll get into some historical context of that. I'll tell you at some point. I'll read you this document that was found, some writings in Hellenistic Greece about a Buddhist community that lived among them. They were called the Theras. They were Theravadan. They were some of King Ashoka's missionaries. King Ashoka sent Theravadan missionaries to all corners of the world, including Judea at the time of Christ, believe it or not. The Essenes and the Buddhists were part of Judea. And where was I? Oh, yeah. So Catholic monasteries were built on the model of Buddhist sanghas, Buddhist universities they were called, and celibacy was adopted, but not the not the spiritual preparations for celibacy that allow Buddhist monks to practice it with equanimity, you know, with emotional detachment, which is why the Catholics have such a hard time with celibacy. And that led to things like flagellation and lots of stuff. They don't know how to they don't know how to practice equanimity with celibacy. But that's another topic. We have about 90 seconds. We can talk to let's talk more about this. Buddha says, with regard to external factors, I don't envision any other single factor like admirable friendship as doing so much for a monk in training who has not attained the heart's goal but remains intent on the unsurpassed safety from bondage. A monk who is a friend with admirable people abandons what is unskillful and develops what is skillful. I found at this point in my life that all my friends are people who are my spiritual peers or my spiritual superiors, and I think this is a good mix. People who are on the path where you are, and people to whom you look up to and see as mentors, people whose achievements you admire and to whom you aspire to be like. The Buddha says, and what is meant by admirable friendship? There's the case where a lay person, in whatever town or village he may dwell, spends time with householders or householder's sons, young or old, who are advanced in virtue. He talks with them, engages them in discussions. He emulates consummate convictions in those who are consummate in conviction. Consummate virtue in those who are consummate in virtue. Consummate generosity in those who are consummate in generosity. This is called admirable friendship. And ba-ba! Yay! Mm-hmm.